Well, because it was daft. And I wanted to defend British Railway. I'd already written one book on this subject, but now they'd actually done it, and I needed to write this other book just in defence of a much more sensible system. The railway is a team. They work as a team. The whole thing supports each other part of the team. And if you break that up, it can't work properly. It'll work. We've got a railway, and I travel on it a lot, and it goes up and down. It's all right until something goes wrong, and then you've got all these different agencies, and nobody seems to want to know. And there's a classic example over at Yarmouth. I've got it in that Blunders book, where a train was derailed as it left Yarmouth Station because the track was so rotten that the sleepers fell apart and the rails parted and the engine fell off, the carriage fell off the line. Now, it's quite obvious it was the track, but Railtrack weren't prepared to admit that it was their fault, although the sleepers were rotted like compost. And they had to wait until 7 o'clock in the evening, and this happened at 10 o'clock in the morning. Yarmouth Station was closed all day long because Railtrack wouldn't admit that it was their fault, and therefore they must pay the costs.
And that was because the railway had been broken up and each bit of the railway had to deal with the other bits through contract.
Whoever's fault that derailment was had to pay the costs of all the other people. Had it been a faulty carriage, then one supposes that's the carriage leasing company's problem. And then they would have had to have paid for the re-railing, the relaying of the track. So nobody wants to admit. And it's so stupid. Curiously enough, one of the guys on the engine in that incident works on the North Norfolk Railway as a volunteer, so I happen to know firsthand exactly what happened. And that wasn't put right until a man arrived from Derby in a helicopter.
Because they just didn't have the staff in that part of the country anymore.
The guy that came to adjudicate and to arbitrate had already been to Glasgow in his helicopter, and now he had to come to Yarmouth in his helicopter. He took one look at it and said, well, the track's rotten.
But the popular understanding was that the nationalised British Railways had never really delivered on its promise. It cost an awful lot of money in subsidies. It employed far too many men.
Yeah.
The unions were very uppity at times.
Yeah.
The whole point was to bring in fresh thinking through privatisation. And the aim was to lead to a better railway.
Yeah.
I mean, the Tories who did this in the 90s, they did have a point, didn't they?
Well, they thought they had a point. What you can't do is break up the team. What a very important railway man said to me, a man who was the chairman of UK Intercity, you know, Intercity, Paddington, Bristol, King's Cross, Leeds. He ran the whole of the UK's Intercity Railway. And he made it make a profit under British Railways. It was paying. And he said, had they sold me Intercity, and if I'd have owned the track and the trains, I would have bought it.
And that is the point, because you point out in the book that it was way back under the Stockton and Darlington in the 1820s, they very quickly realised at that period of time that you had to have this, what you call a unified railway, the track and the trains, to make it all work properly.
Otherwise, I mean, for instance, I've read, it's not that I'm saying this because I'm a nasty person who doesn't like private enterprise or anything like that. If you go and read the minutes of the Stockton and Darlington Railway Company's, you know, meetings, you'll find that they're saying, who is going to pay for the damage to the water column at Darlington? Did anybody see who broke it? Because nobody wants to pay for it. And they said, look, this is no good. We've got to bring all of this under our control. And there is a chapter in that book called Master in Their Own House. And that's what you had to have. And they had to buy out the various people that were using the track. There were innkeepers running horse-drawn carriages along the railway line.
Open access, I think.
It was open access. Only because prior to the railroad, there was the turnpike road. And the turnpike road was free if you paid. Sorry, I mean, it was free in the sense that anyone could use it. You paid your shilling and you use the road. So when the railway very first came along, naturally, that's the system. But they find that the railway is not a road, and it doesn't work like that. When they have a winding engine on the Stockton and Darlington, they would haul coal wagons up steep inclines with a stationary steam engine and a rope around a drum. But there was a contractor who was running the steam engine, and there was a contractor who supplied the rope around the drum. Well, if the rope broke...
Whose fault was it?
Yeah, I mean, the contractor of the steam engine would say, well, it's a rotten rope. And the man would say, no, it's not a rotten rope. You started the rope too suddenly and you snagged it. You can argue forever. You just can't do things like that. And so they gradually brought the railway together. The Liverpool and Manchester Railway had a little bit of open access. They opened in 1830. And by 1833, they had got rid of open access. They said, we can't run like this.
What I like about the greatest railway blunder is how you weave together those stories from the past about how the railway used to work, along with the story of what you consider to be the disaster of privatisation. You've got some marvellous stories about the way that the old-fashioned railway just used to keep going because there were people to do the job.
The first example in the book comes from 1879. There was a vast rainstorm over Anglesey, and a little brook turned into something like Niagara, came thundering down the mountainside and washed away a 9-arch viaduct. It just took it out. So that's the Chester Holyhead main line gone, double track. Within 2 or 3 hours, the chief engineer of the London and North Western Railway is on the scene. Why is he on the scene? Because he's got his own private engine and carriage. So he arrives, has a look at it, and gives his orders in a military fashion. This is another thing they said, oh, you've got to get rid of all this hierarchy stuff. He says to the divisional engineer at Bangor, whose responsibility Anglesey is, this is what I want you to do. Make a cut down the side of the approach embankment to the viaduct, cut your way down, mate, and then move on to a new embankment, but you're falling down to the river. By the time you've made these earth embankments, it'll take you a few days, the river will have returned to its normal small size, put a wooden bridge across it, and we will run a single-track railway over the river.
And the point is that even then, in the 1870s, they had their railway back working within a week, and if that happened now, it would take a month or so.
Longer. I mean, goodness knows. There was a bridge out at Ely not long ago. I'm not quite sure. Oh, it was a derailment. And the bridge was damaged. They had to put a new one in. I forgive me if I could be wrong, but I thought it took a year. It might have been 6 months. I'm not quite sure. But it was that order of... These people, they erected signal boxes. They had proper single-line working instruments installed, and 4 days later, they were running trains. It took a month to get the double-track viaduct rebuilt. And what took longest, of course, was waiting for the cement to dry. That was because the London and North Western Railway possessed every single facility it needed to run its own railway. Didn't have to ask anybody.
And you've got small examples as well. There's the story of how they managed to dig out an unexploded bomb after the Second World War.
Yeah, the ganger is walking along the line between Drayton and Norwich on the MGN, and he finds a bomb. It's there, and he sees it in the undergrowth. So he simply goes back to Drayton Station and gets a wheelbarrow, picked it up, wheeled it back to the station. Meanwhile, the station's called the police, and the police took it away. Boom, boom. I mean, that was it.
And the trains are back running in an
hour. There was no trains running at that, but so they didn't have to stop anything, you know. I mean, I could talk about even what happened on my time in the railway because we were unified. An example now, something once happened at Diss station under this private system. Diss has got a crossover point between the up and the down lines. And the panel wanted to cross an engine from one line to the other. So they reversed the crossover, engine goes across. When they put the crossover back for straight running, ordinary up and down running, the electrical contacts that tell you that the points are properly set don't make. They're not making. So the points are still open as far as the machinery is concerned. The porter on the station is not allowed on the track. because he doesn't belong to the track, he belongs to the franchisee. There is no one at Dis. All you've got to do is walk down the track to the point. So give them a little shove with your boot and they're shut. It's only a 16th of an inch we're talking about here, you see. Can't do it. They had to get a man in a van from Colchester. Meanwhile, of course, because the points are wrong, you can't pull out, get any signals off.
And you've got sort of thing. Trains backing up all the way to London.
Yes, yes. And I just think how very, very silly, that's all.
Looking back through the recent history, going back to the way they actually did the privatisation, why do you think it is that more people didn't make more of a fuss about the way they were doing it?
Ah, well, I suppose you'd have to ask them. I mean, my friend, I do have a friend who's now in the House of Lords, which seems bizarre, but Bill Bradshaw, I knew when he was on Western Region at Bristol, long ago. Bill ended up in the House of Lords. He was general manager at Paddington. He went to British Railways Board. You know, he's a very capable man. He was absolutely opposed. I don't think very many people would have opposed privatisation if it had been sold as companies. If it had been sold as a railway, I mustn't really speak for Bill, I beg his pardon, but I don't think he would have opposed that. It was the way they wanted to do it. Everything was contracted out.
And the fact that they split the track up and took it away from the train, so to speak.
And also, Railtrack, by law, was not allowed to employ very many technicians. 14,000 technicians were sold to the contractors. So they were left with a minimal engineering staff, which again doesn't... I mean, how are they going to supervise their contractors if they haven't got an engineering staff? That sort of thing. And you couldn't make this up. You really couldn't.
What do you think about the days prior to that then? The biggest shake-up in the railway was this man Beeching, who was brought in, and a lot of lines were cut. But in the railway blunders, you really point the finger at the Minister of Transport, don't you? Ernest Marples, who was the man who actually owned a company or was very closely associated with the company that built the motorways.
Ernie Marples was a spiv. He was just a spiv. Terrible man. And he employed Dr. Beeching to look at the railways, and doubtless Beeching had his brief as to what was required. Beeching had already been on the Serple Committee just a bit before that, and the report of that committee, Serple was a Treasury official, and that report was so devastating to the future of the railway that A, they never implemented it, and B, it was kept secret until about 1993, because what it said when we finally got to read it was all you needed was 1,500 miles of railway. So Richard Beeching was already primed, and he did shut railways, which really was a terrible shame to have shut them. And if you look at page 56, the very bottom of page 56 of Beeching's report, it says, and this is astonishing coming from an economist, "I have made no assumptions as to population growth when I make these recommendations." Well, surely you ought to make calculations as to how, for instance, the town of Haverhill, which was an overspill town for London, had its railway shut. Well, they were pouring people in there from London. I mean, is that clever?
But the Labour politicians as well were, the way that you write your book, were equally as bad, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, I don't want to be party political about this. When I was a young signalman at Challow, and I can remember all the old boys, because they all voted Labour, and the old boys used to say to me, "You vote for Harold, my boy. You vote for Harold, and we'll get rid of this Beeching." So I don't know what I voted for, but they all voted for Harold. He gets in. And blow me, he is the man that implements the Beeching report that the Tories did. So forget about party politics. People really, really thought that they could run the country without a railway. I said, and I was laughed at for my pains, even by the old railway men. I said, look, at the moment, there's a fashion for car driving. The roads are fairly empty because people use the trains. If you close these big railways off that you're going to shut off, whilst you might be able to get along the main roads fairly freely, you are not going to be able to get into towns because they're going to be jam-packed solid. Oh, Adrian, you're so negative. Oh, you're a young lad. You should be more, you know, optimistic. And I said, well, it's just a matter of arithmetic. If you don't have public transport and railways, it's all got to go on the cars and you'll have terrific traffic jams. And as a result, wonderful towns like Reading were hacked up and dual carriageways put through them for these motor cars. Of course, you've also got this thing about Ernest Marples. I can definitely show where Marples forbade the railway to carry out improvements so that a contract could be issued to dig a tunnel under the Mersey. And who got the contract? Ernest Marples' company. And I've got him bang to rights on there. That was reported in the Liverpool press at the time, because the railway could spend up to $250,000 without asking the government. Any improvements that cost more than that had to go through him. And he said, no, we won't. All they wanted was, they wanted to improve the railway Mersey tunnel, and he wouldn't allow it. He built a road tunnel instead. And 75% of journeys across the Mersey were by the railway tunnel. It's not as if it wasn't used. And he took the contract. He would say, oh, no, I don't own any shares. They're all in my wife's name. And you say, yeah, right, OK, Ernest.
So given what you know about the early history of the railways and what you've written about privatisation, where do you think the future's going to lie? And also given the fact that we've just had this recent announcement that they're going to electrify that line where you first started your interest.
I mean, of course, from an absolutely personal point of view, you think that's terribly sad to spoil the beautiful Thames Valley with a load, but that's just, you've got to have electric railways. It would be nice if they could put the Southern Third Rail down. Be better than all that. But
let's not be picky.
No. You've got to have electric railways. They're the way to do it. It's green, it's climate friendly and all that. So that's got to be done. And as the railway slowly comes back into, it will come back more and more into a larger organisation where people aren't competing. The big word in privatisation all the time in Parliament, they kept on about competition. It's rubbish. It's nonsense. The railway doesn't want competition. It wants engineers and it wants teamwork. So that is the nature of the railway. That was stated as a fact in 1839 in the very first parliamentary report on railways. They said railways are a natural monopoly. It's their nature. So the railway will gradually come back together again. It'll have to. They'll come back. I mean, it might not be quite the same, you know, but it will come back together in order to be able to work more efficiently. If you've got franchises and you suddenly want, you feel conditions change and you would like to run a rather different service. But the thing is, you've now got a franchisee. Well, he doesn't want to give it up. Why should he? He's paid for it. And so now you've got a problem of, well, how are we going to alter this service? Because we've got to get rid of him. And if we get rid of him, it's going to cost our... You see what I mean? So they're going to have to make larger, more unified, and it will all come back together again, and railways will go on into the future as the only way to travel.
And do you think you'll get back this human warmth that you talk about in your books?
I do think so. I think that when this thing, as with Network Rail, it's a not-for-profit company, they call it. I mean, I don't know quite what that means, but the thing is, they do feel, I know they do, because I know one or two people on Network Rail, they do now feel that the regiment has been reformed, and they feel they're part of the railway. An old friend of mine said to me, a high-ranking railway man, he said, at last I'm a railway man again, when he went back into Network Rail from being employed by a contractor. And the regiment is being reformed, and that's got to be good, and people will appreciate working with the team.
And do you think that we'll end up with lots of little signal boxes like this again?
Oh, no, 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 you won't have anything like that. No, you can't possibly do that, I'm sure. But it'll just have a feeling of unity. And unity, common good, is that a very old expression? You know, unity of purpose, common good. That's the railway, not competition. Competition is hopeless.
Good. Thank you very much.